almost a whimper of pleasure. "I will take the master's gift. I will honor our pact." Slowly, the blade held before him, he sank to one knee. "Hail to Ineluki, Storm King!" The wind sprang up anew, shrieking. Simon reeled back from the flapping, whirling hillfire as the four robed figures lifted their white arms, chanting,
"Ineluki ai! Ineluki ai!"
"No!" Simon's thoughts flurried. "The king! All is lost! Run, Joshua!"
"Sorrow! Sorrow on all the land!"
The fifth hooded shape began to writhe atop the wagon. The black robe fell away, and a shape of fire crimson light was revealed, flapping like a burning sail. A ghastly, heart-gnawing fear beat outward from the thing as it began to grow before Simon's terror-fixed eyes. Bodiless and billowing, larger and larger, until the empty, wind-snapping bulk of it loomed over all, a creature of howling air and glowing redness.
"The devil is here. Sorrow. His name is Sorrow. The king has brought the devil. Morghenes, Holy Osiris, save me, save me, save me!"
He ran mindlessly down through black night, away from the red thing and the exulting something else. The sound of his flight was lost in the screaming wind. Branches tore at his arms and hair and face like claws.
The icy claw of the north, the ruins of Aswan.
And when he fell at last, tumbling, and his spirit fled from such horror, fled away into deeper darkness, it seemed that in the final instant he could hear the very stones of the earth moaning in their beds beneath him. Part 2. Simon Pilgrim. Chapter 15. A Meeting at the Inn. The first thing Simon heard was a humming noise, a dull buzz that pushed insistently against his ear as he struggled toward wakefulness. Half opening an eye, he found himself staring at a monstrosity, a dark, indistinct mass of squirming legs and glittering eyes. He sat up with a startled yelp and a great flailing of arms. The bumblebee that had been guilelessly exploring his nose leaped away in a whir of translucent wings to search for a less excitable perch. He lifted a hand to shade his eyes, startled by the vibrant clarity of the world around him. The daylight was dazzling. The spring sun, as if on imperial procession, had scattered gold on all sides across the grassy downs. Everywhere he looked, the gentle slopes were rich with dandelions and long-stemmed marigolds. Bees hurried among them, nipping from flower to flower, like little doctors discovering, much to their surprise, all their patients getting well at the same time. Simon slumped back down into the grass, clasping his hands behind his head. He had slept a long while. The rich sun was almost straight overhead. It made the hairs on his forearms glow like molten copper. The tips of his ragged shoes looked so far away, he could almost imagine them the peaks of distant mountains. A sudden cold sliver of memory pierced his drowsiness. How had he gotten here? What? A dark presence at his shoulder brought him quickly onto his knees. He turned to see the tree-mantled mass of Thistleborg looming behind him, not half a league away. Every detail was stunningly clear, a pattern of precise edges. But for the troubling throb of memory, it might have seemed comfortable and cool, a placid hill rising through encircling trees, banded with shade and bright green leaves. Along its crest were the anger stones, faint grey points against the blue sky. The vivid spring day was now corrupted by a mist of dream. What had happened last night? He had fled the castle, of course. Those moments, his last with Morghenes, were burned into his very heart. But after? What were these nightmarish memories? Endless tunnels? Elias? A fire and white-haired demons? Dreams. Idiot, bad dreams. terror and tiredness and more terror. I ran through the graveyard at night, fell down at last, slept and dreamed. But the tunnels and a black casket. His head still hurt, but there was also an odd sense of numbness, as if ice had been laid on an injury. The dream had seemed so real. Now it was distant, slippery, and meaningless. A dark pang of fear and pain that would drift away like smoke if he allowed it to. Or at least he hoped it would. He pushed the memories down, burying them as deeply as he could, and closing his mind over them like the lid of a box. It's not as though I don't have enough things to worry about. The bright sun of Beltane Day had smoothed some of the kinks from his muscles, but he was still sore and very hungry. He clambered stiffly to his feet and brushed the clinging grass from his tattered, mud-smeared clothes. He stole another look at Thistleborg. Did the ashes of a great fire still smolder among the stones there? Or had the shattering events of the day before pushed him for a while into madness? The hill stood, impassive. Whatever secrets might lurk beneath the cloak of trees, or nestle in the crown of stones, Simon did not want to know. There were already too many hollows that needed filling. Turning his back on Thistleborg, he faced across the downs to the dark breakfront of the forest. Staring across the vast expanse of open land, he felt a deep sorrow welling up within him, and pity for himself. He was so alone. They had taken everything from him and left him without home or friends. He slapped his hands together in anger and felt the palms sting. Later, later, he would cry. Now he had to be a man. But it was all so horribly unfair. He breathed in and out deeply and looked again to the distant woods. Somewhere near that thin line of shadow, he knew, ran the old forest road. It rolled for miles along Aldeorta's southern perimeter, sometimes at a distance, sometimes sidling up close to the old trees like a teasing child. In other places, it actually passed beneath the forest's eaves, winding through dark bowers and silent sun-arrowed clearings. A few small villages and an occasional roadhouse nestled in the forest shadow. Perhaps I can find some work to do, even to earn a meal anyway. I feel hungry as a bear, a just-woken bear at that. Starved. I haven't eaten since before. He bit his lip hard. There was nothing else to do but start walking. The touch of the sun felt like a benediction. As it warmed his sore body, it seemed also to cut a little way through the clinging, troubling pall of his thoughts. In a way, he felt newborn, like the colt Shem had brought him to see last spring, all shaky legs and curiosity. But the new strangeness of the world was not all innocent. Something strange and secretive lurked behind the bright tapestry laid out before him. The colors were almost too bright, the scents and sounds oversweet. He was soon uncomfortably aware of Morgaini's manuscript tucked into his waistband, but after he had tried carrying the sheaf of parchment in his sweating palms for a few hundred paces, he gave up and slipped it back under his belt. The old man had asked him to save the thing, and save it he would. He pushed his shirt tail behind it to ease the rubbing. When he tired of searching patiently for places to ford the small streams that webbed the meadows, he took off his shoes. The smell of the grasslands and the moist mere air, untrustworthy indicators though they were, nevertheless went some way toward keeping his thoughts from straying toward the black, hurting places. The feel of mud between his toes helped too. Before long he reached the old forest road. Instead of continuing along the road itself, which was wide and muddy and scored with the rain-filled ruts of wagon wheels, Simon turned west and accompanied its passage atop the high grass bank. Below him, white asphodels and blue gillyflowers stood abashed and unprotected between the wheel marks, as though surprised in the midst of a slow pilgrimage from one bank to the other. Puddles caught the sky's afternoon blue, and the humble mud seemed studded with shining glass. A furlong away across the road, the trees of Aldeorta stood in endless formation, like an army asleep on its feet. Darknesses, so complete that they might have been portals into the earth, gaped between some of the trunks. In other places were things that must be woodcutters' huts, noticeably angular against the forest's graceful lines. Walking, staring at the interminable forest porch, Simon tripped over a berry bush and painfully scratched both his feet. As soon as he realized what he had stumbled over, he stopped cursing. Most of the berries were still green, but enough had ripened that his cheeks and chin were thoroughly stained with berry juice when he continued on some minutes later, chewing contentedly. The berries were not quite sweet yet, but still they seemed the first serious argument he had found in a long time for the benevolent ordering of creation. When he finished, he wiped his hands on his ruined shirt. As the road, with Simon for company, began to mount a long track of rising ground, definite evidence of human habitation finally appeared. Here and there, in the southerly distance, the rough spines of splitwood fences pushed up from the high grass. Beyond these weathered boundary wardens were indistinct figures moving in the slow rhythms of planting, putting down the spring peas. Somewhere nearby, others would be moving deliberately down the rows, plying the weed hooks, doing their best to save the fruits of a bad year. The younger folk would be up on the cottage roofs, turning back the thatch, beating it down firmly with long sticks, and pulling off the moss that had grown during the rains of Avril. He felt a strong urge to head out across the fields toward those calm, ordered farms. Someone would surely give him work, take him in, feed him. How stupid can I be? He thought. Why don't I just walk back to the castle and stand shouting in the commons yard? Country folk were notoriously suspicious of strangers, especially these days with rumours of banditry and worse drifting down from the north. The Erkingard would be looking for him, Simon felt sure. These isolated farms would be very likely to remember a red-haired young man who had recently passed by. Besides, he was in no hurry to speak to strangers anyway, not so close to the hayholt. Perhaps he would be better off in one of the inns that bordered the mysterious forest, if one would have him. I do know something about working in kitchens, don't I? Someone will give me work, won't they? Topping a rise, he saw the road before him, intersected by a dark swath, a crease of wagon tracks that emerged from the forest and meandered south across the fields. A woodsman's road, perhaps, a route from the woodchopper's harvesting place to the farmlands west of Urchester. Something dark stood, angular and erect, at the meeting point of the two roads. A brief twinge of fear passed through him before he realized that it was too tall an object to be someone waiting for him. He guessed it to be a scarecrow, or a roadside shrine to Elysia, the mother of God. Crossroads were infamously strange places, and the common folk often mounted a holy relic to keep away loitering ghosts. As he neared the crossing, he decided that he had been right about it being a scarecrow. The object seemed to be hanging from a tree or pole and swayed softly, breeze blown. But as he came closer, he saw that it was no scarecrow. Soon, he could no longer convince himself that it was anything other than what it was, the body of a man swinging from a crude gibbet. He reached the crossroad. The wind subsided. Thin roadway dust hung about him in a brown cloud. He stopped to stare helplessly. The road grit settled, then leaped into swirling motion once more. The hanged man's feet, bare and swollen black, dangled at the height of Simon's shoulder. His head lolled to one side, like a puppy picked up by the neck scruff. The birds had been at his eyes and face. A broken shingle of wood with the words, the king's land, scratched upon it, bumped gently against his chest. In the road below lay another piece. On it was scrawled, Poached Fraw. Simon stepped back. An innocent breeze twisted the sagging body, so that the face tipped away to stare sightlessly across the fields. He hurried across the lumber road, tracing the four-pointed tree on his chest as he passed through the thing's shadow. Normally such a sight would be fearful but fascinating, as dead things were. But now all he could feel was sick terror. He himself had stolen, or helped to steal, something far greater than this poor sneak thief could ever have dreamed of. He had stolen the king's brother from the king's own dungeon. How long would it be until they caught him? As they had caught this rook-eaten creature, what would his punishment be? He looked back once. The ruined face had swung again, as if to watch his retreat. He ran until a dip in the road had blocked the crossing from view. It was late afternoon when he reached the tiny village of Flett. It was truthfully not much of a village, just an inn and a few houses crouching beside the road, within a stone's throw of the woods. No people were about, except a thin woman standing in the doorway of one of the rude houses, and a pair of solemn, round-eyed children that peered out past her legs. There were, however, several horses, farm nags mostly, tied to a log before the town's inn, the dragon and fisherman. As Simon walked slowly past the open door, looking cautiously all around, men's loud voices rolled out from the beery darkness, frightening him. He decided to wait and try his luck later, when there might be more customers stopping off the old forest road for the night, and his dirty, tattered appearance would be less notable. He followed the road a little farther. His stomach was rumbling, making him wish he had saved some of his berries. There were only a few more houses and a little one-room cottage church. Then the road swerved up and under the forest's eaves, and Flett, such as it was, ended. Just past the edge of town, he found a small stream gurgling along over the black, leafy soil. He knelt and drank, ignoring the brambles and the dampness as best he could. He took his shoes back off again to use for a pillow and curled up at the base of a live oak, just out of sight of the road and the last house. He fell asleep quickly beneath the trees, a grateful guest in their cool hall. Simon dreamed. He found an apple lying on the ground at the foot of a great white tree, an apple so shiny and round and red that he hardly dared to bite it. But his hunger was strong, and soon he lifted it to his mouth and set his teeth in it. The taste was wonderful, all crunch and sweetness. But when he looked where he had bitten, he saw the thin, slippery body of a worm coiled beneath the bright surface. He could not bear to throw the apple away, however. It was such a beautiful fruit, and he was famished. He turned it around and bit into the other side, but as his teeth met, he pulled away and saw once more the sinuous body of the worm. Over and over he bit, each time in a different place, but each time the slithering thing lay beneath the skin. It seemed to have no head or tail, but only endless coils wound around the core, spreading through the apple's cool white flesh. Simon awoke beneath the trees with an aching head and a sour taste in his mouth. He went to the streamlet to drink, feeling faint and weak of spirit. When had anyone ever been so alone? The slanting afternoon light did not touch the sunken surface of the creek. As he kneeled for a moment, staring down into the murmuring dark water, he felt he had been in a place like this before. As he wondered, the soft wind speech of the trees was overwhelmed by a rising murmur of voices. For a moment he feared he was dreaming again, but as he turned, he saw a crowd of people, a score at least, coming up the old forest road toward Flett. Still in the shadow of the trees, he moved forward to watch them, drying his mouth with the arm of his shirt. The marchers were peasant folk, dressed in the rough cotsman's cloth of the district, but with a festive air. The women had ribbons twined in their unpinned hair, blue and gold and green. Skirts twirled about bare ankles. Some who ran in front carried flower petals in their aprons, which they cast fluttering to the ground. The men, some young and light-footed, some limping gaffers, carried on their shoulders a felled tree. Its branches were as ribbon-festooned as the women, and the menfolk held it high, swinging it jauntily as they came up the road. Simon smiled weakly. The Maya tree, of course. It was Beltane Day today, and they were bringing the Maya tree. He had often watched the tree go up in Urchester's Battle Square. Suddenly, his smile felt too wide. He was light-headed. He crouched lower among the concealing brush. Now the women were singing, their sweet voices mixing unevenly as the throng danced and whirled. Come now to the Brereton, come to the Hill of Briars, put on your merry flower crown, come dance beside my fire. The men replied, voices ragged and cheerful, I'll dance before your fire, lass, then in the forest's shadow we'll lay a bed of blossoms down and put an end to sorrow. Both together sang the refrain. So stand beneath this ear, Mansol, sing hey up, hey, Yarrow. Stand beneath the maypole, sing hey up, God is growing. The women were beginning another verse, one about hollyhock and lily leaves and the king of flowers, as the noisy band drew abreast of Simon. Caught up for a moment in the high spirits, his dizzy head full of the exuberant music, he began to push forward. Not 10 paces away on the sun-blotted road, one of the men nearest him stumbled, a trailing ribbon coiled about his eyes. A companion helped him to disentangle himself, and as he pulled the gold streamer loose, his whiskery face creased in a broad grin. For some reason, the flash of laughing teeth held Simon a step short of leaving the concealment of the trees. What am I doing? He berated himself. The first sound of friendly voices and I go bounding out into the open. These people are merrymakers, but a hound will play with his master too. And woe to the stranger that comes up unannounced. The man he had been watching shouted something to his companion, which Simon could not hear over the din of the crowd, then turned and held up a ribbon, shouting to someone else. The tree jounced along, and when the procession's last stragglers had passed, Simon slipped out onto the road and followed. A thin, rag-wrapped figure, he might have been the tree's mournful spirit, wistfully pursuing its stolen home. The lurching parade turned up a small hill behind the church. Across the broad fields, the last splinter of sun was vanishing fast. The shadow of the church's rooftop tree lay across the hillock like a long, curve-hilted knife. Not knowing what was planned, Simon hung well back of the group as they carried the tree up the slight rise, stumbling and catching on the new-sprung briars. At the top, the men gathered, sweaty and full of loud jests, and levered the trunk upright into a hole dug there. Then, while some held the swaying bulk steady, others shored up the base with stones. At last they stepped back. The mayor tree tottered a bit, then tipped slightly to one side, drawing a gasp of apprehensive laughter from the crowd. It held, only slightly out of plumb. A great cheer went up. Simon in the tree shadows gave voice himself to a small happy noise, then had to retreat into hiding as his throat tightened. He coughed until blackness fluttered before his eyes. It had been nearly a full day since he had uttered a spoken word. Eyes watering, he crept back out. A fire had been kindled at the hill's foot, with its highest point painted by the sunset, and the flames jigging down below. The tree seemed a torch fired at both ends. Irresistibly drawn by the scent of food, Simon moved near to the gaffers and gossips who were spreading cloths and laying supper by the stone wall behind the little church. He was surprised and disappointed to see how meager the stores were. Slim rewards for a festival day, and dreadful luck, an even slimmer chance of him making off with any unnoticed. The younger men and women had begun to dance around the base of the mayor tree, trying to make a ring. The circle, with drunken tumbling down the hill and other impediments, never became completely joined. The spectators whooped to see the dancers vainly reaching for a hand to close on as they whirled giddily by. One by one, the merrymakers reeled away from the dance, staggering, sometimes rolling down the low hill, to lie at the bottom laughing helplessly. Simon ached to join them. Soon knots of people were sitting all about the grass and along the wall. The highest tip of the tree was a ruby spearhead, capturing the sun's final rays. One of the men at the base of the hill brought out a shinbone flute and began to play. A gradual silence descended as he piped, touched only by whispers and an occasional squeak of muffled laughter. At last the breathing blue darkness surrounded them all. the plaintive voice of the flute soared above, like the spirit of a melancholy bird. A young woman, black-haired and thin-faced, got to her feet, steadying herself on the shoulder of her young man. Swaying gently, like a slim birch tree in the wind's path, she began to sing. Simon felt the great hollowness inside himself open up to the song, to the evening, to the patient, contented smell of the grass and other growing things. "O faithful friend, O linden tree," she sang, "that sheltered me when I was young, O tell me of my faithless one, befriend again to me. The one who was my heart's desire, who promised all for all in turn, has left me lorn, my heart has spurned, and made of love a liar. Where has he gone, O linden tree, into the arms of what sweet friend? What call will bring him back again? O spy him out for me. Ask me not that, my mistress fair, I'd fain not make answer to you, for I could only answer true, and I would your feelings spare. Deny me not, O linden tall, tell me who holds him close tonight. What woman has o'erthrown my right, who keeps him from my call? O mistress fair, then truth I'll tell, he'll not to you come any more. Tonight he walked the river shore, and stumbled there and fell. The river woman now he holds, and she in turn holds fast to him, but she will send him back again, all river wet and cold. Thus will he come from there again, all river wet and cold. As the black-haired girl sat down again, the fire crackled and spat, as if in mockery of such a damp, tender song. Simon hurried away from the fire, his eyes filling with tears. The woman's voice had awakened in him a fierce hunger for his home, for the joking voices of the scullions, the offhand kindnesses of the chambermaids, his bed, his moat, the long sun-speckled expanse of Morgane's chambers, even, he was chagrined to realize, the stern presence of Rachel the dragon. The murmurs and laughter behind him filled the spring darkness like the whir of soft wings. A score or so of people were in the street before the church. Most of them, in knots of two or three or four, seemed headed through the settling darkness toward the dragon and fisherman. Firelight glowed within the door there, stippling the loiterers on the porch with yellow light. As Simon approached, still wiping at his eyes, the odors of meat and brown ale rolled over him like an ocean wave. He walked slowly, several paces behind the last group, wondering if he should ask for work right off, or just wait in the sociable warmth until later, when the innkeeper might have a moment to speak with him and see that he was a trustworthy lad. It made him fearful just to think about asking a stranger to take him in, but what else could he do? Sleep in the forest like a beast? As he squirmed through a clump of drunken farmers arguing the merits of late-season shearing, he nearly tripped over a dark figure huddled against the wall beneath the inn's swinging sign. A round pink face with small dark eyes turned up to stare at him. Simon mumbled noises of apology and was moving on when he remembered. "I know you," he said to the crouching figure. The dark eyes widened as if in alarm. "You're the friar I met in the main row, Brother Cadrach." Cadrach, who for a brief moment had looked as though he might scramble away on hands and knees, narrowed his eyes to stare in turn. "Don't you remember me?" he said excitedly. The sight of a familiar face was as heady as wine. "My name is Simon." A couple of the farmers turned to look blearily and incuriously in their direction, and he felt a stab of fright, remembering that he was a fugitive. "My name is Simon," he repeated in a softer voice. A look of recognition and something else passed over the monk's plump face. "Simon? Ah, of course, boy. What brings you then up from the great Urchester to dismal little flat?" With the aid of a long stick that had been leaning against the wall beside him, Cadrach climbed to his feet. "Well," Simon was nonplussed. "Yes, what have you been doing, you idiot, that you should strike up conversation with near strangers? Think, stupid. Morgane's tried to tell you that this was no game." "I have been on an errand,"
for some people at the castle. And you decided to take the small bit of money left to you and stop at the famous dragon and fisherman. Cadrach made a wry face, and have a bit of something to eat. Before Simon could correct him, or decide if he wanted to, the monk continued, "What you should be after, then, is taking your supper with me, and let me pay your count. No, no, lad, I insist. It is only a fairness, after the kindly ways you showed to a stranger." Simon could not utter a word before Brother Cadrach had his arm, pulling him into the public room. A few faces turned as they entered, but no one's eyes lingered. The room was long and low-ceilinged, lined along both walls with tables and benches, so wine-stained, hacked and carved upon, that they seemed held together only by the dried gravy and suet, with which they were so generously splattered. At the end nearest the door, a roaring fire burned in a wide stone fireplace. A sooty, sweating peasant lad was turning a joint of beef on a spit. He winced as the dripping fat made the flames sizzle. To Simon it all suddenly looked and smelled like heaven. Cadrach dragged him to a spot along the back wall. The tabletop was so cracked and pitted that it hurt to rest his skinned elbows on its surface. The monk took the seat across from him, leaning back against the wall and extending his legs down the length of the bench. Instead of the sandals that Simon would have expected, the friar wore ragged boots, splitting from weather and hard use.
"Innkeeper! Where are you, worthy publican?" Cadrach called.
A pair of beetle-browed, blue-jawed locals, that Simon would have sworn were twins, looked over from the opposite table with annoyance written in every facial furrow. After a little wait, the owner appeared, a barrel-chested, bearded man with a deep scar across his nose and upper lip.
"Ah, there you are," said Cadrach. "Bless you, my son, and bring us each a mug of your best ale. Then, will you be so good as to carve us off some of that joint? That and two trenchers of bread to sop with? Thanks to you, laddie."
The owner frowned at Cadrach's words, but nodded his head curtly and walked away. As he left, Simon heard him grumble, "Earnest, stirry buggerer." The ale came soon, and then the meat, then more ale. At first, Simon ate like a starving dog, but after easing his initial desperate hunger and looking about the room to make sure no one was paying them undue attention, he slowed his pace and began to attend to Brother Cadrach's meandering conversation. The Hernest Stearman was a wonderful storyteller, despite the burr of his accent that sometimes made him a little difficult to understand. Simon was vastly amused by the tale of the harper, Ithineg, and his long, long night, despite being a bit shocked to hear such a story told by a man of the cloth. He laughed so hard at the adventures of Red Hathrehin and the Scythi woman Finaju that he sprayed ale over his already stained shirt. They had lingered a long while. The inn was half empty when the bearded innkeeper finished filling their mugs for the fourth time. Cadrach, with broad gesticulation, was telling Simon of a fight he had once witnessed on the docks of Ansis Pelipe in Perdruin. Two monks, he explained, had cudgeled each other into near unconsciousness during an argument about whether or not the Lord Osiris had magically freed a man from a pig spell on the island of Grenamam. Just at the most exciting point, Brother Cadrach was waving his arms so enthusiastically in the description that Simon feared he would fall off the bench. The tavern keeper thumped an ale jug loudly down in the middle of the table. Cadrach, caught in mid-exclamation, looked up.
"Yes, my good sir," he asked, cocking a bushy brow. "And how can we be helping you?"
The innkeeper stood with arms folded, a look of suspicion pinching his face.
"I've let you stand credit so far, 'cause you're a man of the faith, father," he said. "But I must be closing up soon." "Is that all that's afflicting you?"
A smile raced across Cadrach's round face.
"We'll be right over to reckon up with you, good fellow. What was your name, then?"
"Friawaru."
"Well, never fear, then, goodman Friawaru. Let the lad and me be finishing these noggins, and then we'll let you get your sleep."
Friawaru nodded in his beard, more or less satisfied, and stumped off to yell at the turnspit boy. Cadrach emptied his mug with a long and noisy swallow, then turned his grin on Simon.
Drink up now, lad. We must not keep the man waiting. I am of the Granizian order, you know, and have a feeling for the poor fellow. Among other things, good Saint Granice is the patron of innkeepers and drunkards. A natural enough pairing.
Simon chuckled and drained his cup. But as he put it down, a finger of memory tugged at him. Hadn't Cadrach told him, when they first met in Urchester, that he was of some other order? Something with a V? Valdareven? The monk was fishing about the pockets of his robe with a look of great concentration on his face, so Simon let the question pass. After a moment, Cadrach pulled out a leather purse and dropped it on the table. It made no sound, no clink, no jingle. Cadrach's shining forehead wrinkled in a look of concern, and he held the purse up to his ear and slowly shook it. There was still no sound. Simon stared.
"Ah, laddie, laddie," said the friar mournfully. "Will you look at that now? I stopped to help a poor beggarman today. Carried him down to the water, I did, and washed his bleeding feet. And look what he has done to repay my kindness."
Cadrach turned the purse over so that Simon could see the gaping hole slit across the bottom.
"Can you wonder why I sometimes fear for this wicked world, young Simon? I helped the man, and, why, he must have robbed me even as I was carrying him."
The monk heaved a great sigh.
"Well, lad, I'm afraid I'll have to prevail on your human kindness and aid a knight charity to lend me the money that we are owing here. I can soon pay you back, never fear."
He clucked, waving the slit wallet at the gape-eyed Simon.
"Oh, but this world is sick with sin."
Simon heard Cadrach's words only vaguely, a babble of sounds in his ale-muddled head. He was looking not at the hole, but at the seagull worked on the leather in heavy blue thread. The pleasant drunkenness of a minute before had turned heavy and sour. After a moment he raised his stare until his eyes met Brother Cadrach's. The ale and the warmth of the commons room had flushed Simon's cheeks and ears, but now he felt a tide of blood that was hotter still, mounting up from his fast-beating heart.
"That's my purse," he said.
Cadrach blinked like an undenned badger.
"What, lad?"
he asked apprehensively, sliding slowly away from the wall to the middle of the bench.
"I'm afraid I was not hearing you well."
"That purse is mine!"
Simon felt all the hurt, all the frustration of losing it come welling up. Judith's disappointed face, Dr. Morgani's sad surprise, and the shocked sickness of trust betrayed. All the red hairs on his neck stood up like boar's bristles.
"Thief!"
he shouted suddenly, and lunged, but Cadrach had seen it coming. The little monk was off the bench and skittering backward up the length of the inn toward the door.
"No, wait, boy, it's a mistake you're making,"
he shouted, but if he really thought so, he did not seem to have much faith in his ability to convince Simon. Without pausing for a moment, he grabbed his stick and sprang out of the doorway. Simon was after him at a sprint, but was barely through the door jamb when he felt himself grappled around the waist by a pair of bear-like arms. A moment later, he was up off the floor, breath pressed out, legs helplessly dangling.
"Now what do you think you're doing, hey?"
Friawaru grunted in his ear. Turning in the doorway, he flipped Simon back into the fire-painted commons room. Simon landed on the wet floor and lay gasping for a moment.
"It's the monk," he groaned at last. "He stole my purse. Don't let him get away."
Friawaru poked his head briefly outside the door.
"Well, if that's true, he's long gone, that one. But how do I know this isn't all part of the plan, hey? How do I know that you two don't play this monk and catamite trick in every inn between here and Utan Yeet?"
A couple of late drinkers laughed behind him.
"Get up, boy,"
he said, grasping Simon's arm and yanking him roughly onto his feet.
"I'm going to see if Day or Helm or Godstan has heard of you pair before."
He hustled Simon out the door and around the side of the building, holding his arm prisoned in a firm grip. The moonlight picked out the stable's roof of pallid thatch, and the first tree sentinels of the forest a stone throw away.
"I don't know why you didn't just ask for work, you donkey," Friawaru growled as he propelled the stumbling youth before him. With my hay and fax just quit, I could have used a good-sized young fella like you. Bloody foolishness. And just you keep your mouth shut.
Alongside the stable was a small cottage, standing out but still connected to the main body of the inn. Freyawaru banged his fist on the door.
There you are, Helm, he called. Are you up? Come look at this lad and tell me if you've seen him before.
The sound of footsteps could be heard within.
Bloody tree, is that you, Freyawaru? A voice grumbled. We have to be on the road at cockcrow.
The door swung open. The room behind was lit by several candles.
Lucky for you, we were dicing and not abed yet, said the man who'd opened the door. What is it?
Simon's eyes went wide, and his heart exploded into horrified pounding. This man, and the one polishing his sword on one of the bedsheets, wore the green livery of Elias Erkengard.
This young ruffian and thief of a...
Freyawaru had just time to say when Simon turned and butted his head into the innkeeper's stomach. The bearded man went down with a startled outrush of breath. Simon sprang over his kicking legs and headed for the shelter of the forest. In a few leaping steps he had disappeared. The two soldiers gazed after him in mute surprise. On the ground in front of the candlelit doorway, Freyawaru the tavern keeper cursed and rolled and kicked and cursed. Chapter 16. The White Arrow.
It's not fair,
Simon sobbed for perhaps the 100th time, fisting the wet ground. Leaves stuck to his reddened knuckles. He did not feel the least bit warmer.
Not fair,
he murmured, curling back into a ball. The sun had been up for an hour, but the thin light brought no heat. Simon shivered and wept. And it wasn't fair. It wasn't at all. What had he done that he should be lying damp, miserable and homeless, in the Aldeota forest while others were asleep in warm beds, or just risen to bread and milk and dry clothes? Why should he be hunted and chased like some filthy animal? He had tried to do what was right, to help his friend and the prince, and it had made of him a starveling outcast. But Morgane's got far worse, didn't he? A part of him pointed out contemptuously. The poor doctor would probably shift places with you, gladly. Even that, though, was beside the point. Dr. Morgane's at least had possessed some idea of what was involved, of what might happen. He himself had been, he thought disgustedly, as innocent and stupid as a mouse who goes out of doors to play tag with a cat.
Why does God hate me so? Simon wondered, sniffling.
How could Osiris Aiden, who the priest said watched over everyone, have left him to suffer and die in the wilderness like this? He burst out in fresh weeping. Rubbing his eyes some time later, he wondered how long he had been lying there, staring at nothing. He pulled himself up, moving away from the sheltering tree, to shake the life back into his hands and feet. He returned to the tree long enough to empty his bladder, then stalked sullenly down to the tiny stream to drink. The merciless ache in his knees, back and neck rebuked him with every step.
Damn everyone to hell, and damn the bloody forest, and God too for that matter.
He looked up fearfully from his chill handful of water, but his silent blasphemy went unpunished. When he had finished, he moved upstream a short distance, to a place where the stream eddied out into a pool, and the turbulent waters were smoothed. As he crouched, staring at his tear-rippled reflection, he felt a resistance at his waist that made it difficult to bend over without steadying himself with his hands.
The doctor's manuscript, he remembered.
He half stood, pulling the warm, flexible mass out from between pants and shirt front. His belt had smashed a crease the length of the whole bundle. He had carried them so long that the pages were molded to the curve of his belly like a piece of armor. In his hand they lay bowed like a wind-breasted sail. The top page was smeared and caked with dirt. But Simon recognized the doctor's small, intricate script. He had been wearing the thin armor of Morgane's words. He felt a sudden fierce pang like hunger, and put the papers gently aside, returning his gaze to the pool. It took a moment to separate his own reflection from the bands and blotches of shadow cast on the water's surface. The light was behind him. His image was largely silhouette, a dark figure with only the suggestion of features along the illuminated temple, cheek, and jaw. Twisting his head to catch the sun, he looked from the corner of his eye to see a hunted animal mirrored in the water, its ear tilted as though listening for pursuit, hair a tangled hedge of tufts, neck angled in a way that spoke not of civilization, but of watchfulness and fear. He quickly gathered up the manuscript and walked up the stream bank.
I'm completely alone. No one will take care of me ever again. Not that anyone ever did.
He thought he could feel his heart breaking within his chest. After searching for a few minutes, he found a patch of sunlight and settled down to dry his tears and think. It seemed obvious as he listened to the echoing speech of birds in the otherwise soundless forest that he must find warmer clothes if he was going to spend nights out of doors, and that he would certainly have to do until he got farther away from the hayholt. He also needed to decide where he was going. He began to leaf absently through Morgani's papers, each one dense with words. Words. How could anyone think of so many words at one time, let alone write them down? It made his brain hurt just thinking about it. And what good were they, he thought, his lip trembling with bitterness, when you were cold and hungry, or when Priorates was at your door? He pulled two pages apart. The bottom one tore, and he felt as though he had unwittingly insulted a friend. He stared at it for a moment, solemnly tracing the familiar calligraphy with a scratched finger, then held it up to catch the light, squinting his eyes to read.
It is strange, then, to think how those who wrote the songs and stories that entertained John's glittering court made of him, in an effort to construct him larger than life, less than he truly was.
Reading it through the first time, puzzling it word by word, he could make nothing of it. But as he read it again, the cadences of Morgani's speech came out. He almost smiled, forgetting for a moment his horrible situation. It still made little sense to him, but he recognized the voice of his friend.
Consider, for example, it continued, his coming to Erkinland, out of the island of Warrensten. The balladeers would have it that God summoned him to slay the dragon Shurike, that he touched shore at Grenafod with his sword Brightnail in his hand, his mind set only on this great task. While it is possible that a benevolent God called him to free the land from the fearsome beast, it remains to be explained why God allowed said dragon to lay waste to the country for long years, before raising up its nemesis. And of course, those who knew him in those days remembered that he left Warrensten a swordless farmer's son, and reached our shores in the same condition. Nor did he even think on the Red Worm, until he had the better part of a year in our Erkin land.
It was vastly comforting to hear Morgani's voice again, even if it was only in his own head. But he was puzzled by the passage. Was Morgani's trying to say that Prester John had not killed the Red Dragon, or only that he had not been chosen by God to do so? If he hadn't been chosen by the Lord Osiris in heaven, how had he killed the Archbeast? Didn't the people of Erkinland say he was the king, anointed by God? As he sat thinking, a cold wind kited down through the trees and raised goose flesh on his arms.
Aiden, curse it! I must find a cloak or something warm to wear, he thought, and decide where I am going, instead of sitting here mooning like a half-wit over old writings.
It seemed obvious now that his plan of the previous day, that of covering himself with a shallow layer of anonymity, becoming a turnspit or a scrubber at some rural hostel, was an impossible notion. Whether the two guardsmen he had escaped would have known him was not the issue. If they hadn't recognized him, someone eventually would. He felt sure that Elias' soldiers were already beating the countryside for him. He was not just a runaway servant, he was a criminal, a terrible criminal. Several deaths had already been paid out over the issue of Joshua's escape. There would be no mercy for Simon if he fell into the hands of the Erkengard. How could he escape? Where would he go? He felt the panic rising again and tried to suppress it. Morgaini's dying wish had been that he follow Joshua to Naglamund. It seemed now that was the only useful course. If the prince had made good his escape, surely he would welcome Simon. If not, then doubtless Joshua's liegemen would trade sanctuary for news of their lord. Still, it was a dismally long way to Naglamund. Simon knew the route and distance only by repute, but no one would call it short. If he continued to follow the old forest road west, eventually it would cross the Wealdhelm Road, which ran northward along the base of the hills from which it took its name. If he could find the Wealdhelm Way, he would at least be headed in the right direction. With a strip torn from the hem of his shirt, he bound the papers up, rolling them into a cylinder and wrapping the cloth around it, tying it with a careful twist of the ends. He noticed that he had neglected a page. It lay to one side, and as he picked it up, he saw that it was the one his own sweat had smeared. In the blur of ruined letters, one sentence had escaped. The words leaped out at him. If he was touched by divinity, it was most evident in his comings and goings, in his finding the correct place to be at the most suitable time and profiting thereby. It was not exactly a fortune-telling or a prophecy, but it strengthened him a little and hardened his resolve. Northward it would be, northward to Naglamund. A prickly, painful, miserable day's journey in the lee of the old forest road was salvaged in part by a fortuitous discovery. As he stilted through the brush, skirting the occasional cottage that crouched within hailing distance of the road, he caught a glimpse through the chink in the forest cover of a treasure beyond price, someone's untended washing. As he crept toward the tree, whose branches were festooned with damp clothes and one rank, sodden blanket, he kept his eye on the shabby, bramble-thatched cabin that stood a few paces away. His heart beat swiftly as he pulled down a wool cloak so heavy with moisture that he staggered when it slid free into his arms. No alarm was raised from the cottage. In fact, no one seemed to be about anywhere. For some reason, this made him feel even worse about the theft. As he scrambled back into the tangled trees with his burden, he saw again in his mind's eye a crude wooden sign bumping against an unbreathing chest. The thing of it was, Simon quickly realized, living the outlaw life was nothing at all like the stories of Jack Mundwoda the bandit that Shem had told him. In his imaginings, Haldeota Forest had been a sort of endless high hall with a floor of smooth turf and tall tree-trunk pillars propping a distant ceiling of leaves and blue sky. An airy pavilion where knights like Sir Talistro of Perdruin or the great Camaris rode prancing chargers and delivered ensorcelled ladies from hideous fates. Stranded in an uncompliant, almost malevolent reality, Simon found that the trees of the forest fringe huddled close together, branches intertwining like slip-knotted snakes. The undergrowth itself was an obstacle, an endless humped field of brambles and fallen trunks that lay nearly invisible beneath moss and mouldering leaves. In those first days when he occasionally found himself in a clearing and could walk unencumbered for a short while, the sound of his own footfalls drumming on the loose-packed soil made him feel exposed. He caught himself hurrying across the dells in the slanting sunlight, praying for the security of the undergrowth again. This failure of nerve so infuriated him that he forced himself to cross these clearings slowly. Sometimes he even sang brave songs, listening to the echo as though the sound of his voice quailing and dying in the muffling trees was the most natural thing in the world. But once he had regained the brambles, he could seldom remember what he had sung. Although memories of his life at the Hayholt still filled his head, they had become wisps of remembrance that seemed increasingly distant and unreal, replaced by a growing fog of anger and bitterness and despair. His home and happiness had been stolen from him. Life at the Hayholt had been a grand and easeful thing. The people kind, the accommodations wonderfully comfortable. Now he crashed through the tortuous forest hour after bleak hour, awash in misery and self-pity. He felt his old Simon self vanishing away, and more of his waking thought revolving around only two things, moving forward and eating. At first he had pondered long over whether he should take the open roadway for speed and risk discovery, or try and follow it from the safety of the forest. The last had seemed the better idea, but he quickly discovered that the two, road and forest fringe, diverged widely at certain points, and in the thick tangle of Old Heart it was often frighteningly difficult to find the road again. He also realized with painful embarrassment that he did not have the slightest idea of how to make a fire, something he had never thought about, as he listened to Shem describing droll Mundwoda and his bandit fellows feasting on roast venison at their woodland table. With no torch to light his way, it seemed that the only possible thing to do was to follow the road at night, when moonlight permitted it. He would then sleep by daylight and use the remaining hours of sun to slog through the forest. No torch meant no cook fire, and this was in some ways the hardest blow of all. From time to time he found clutches of speckled eggs deposited by the mother grouse in hiding holes of matted grass. These provided some nourishment, but it was hard to suck out the sticky, cold yolks without thinking of the warm, scented glories of Judith's kitchen, and to reflect bitterly on the mornings when he had been in such a tearing hurry to see Morgainis or get out to the tawny field, that he had left great chunks of butter and honey-smeared bread untouched on his plate. Now, suddenly, the thought of a buttered crust was a dream of riches. Incapable of hunting, knowing little or nothing about what wild plants might be eaten without harm,